put your son on the goddamned phone, Huck had shouted at Irene. I need to know exactly where he dropped her off. Irene gave the phone to Cash. Cash sounded worried and kept apologizing. He should have brought her straight home, he said. You're goddamned right you should have brought her home, Huck said. You should have checked with me. I'm her family. I'm her only family. You're not, though, Cash had said. I'm her brother. You can't possibly be accusing me of intentionally putting her in danger. I'm accusing you of being thoughtless, Huck said, and negligent. She was a child in your care. Huck slammed down the phone. He was livid. The Steele family, one and all, are pirates, he decides. And now they're trying to steal Maya. Well, Huck won't allow it. He sits in his car, fuming, wondering who to call. Joni's mother? Shane's parents? As he's wondering about this, his phone rings. Irene, it says. What? He barks. Huck, please calm down, Irene says. Whatever you said to Cash really upset him. You and I both know it was an innocent mistake. Why don't you come pick me up and we'll look for Maya together? Or I can take one of the jeeps and meet you in town? How about you and your family stay away from my granddaughter, Huck says, assuming I can even find her. Your numbskull son dropped her off at Powell Park when it was nearly dark. She's 12 years old, Irene. 12. That is called gross negligence in my book. Now, I'm going to hang up and find my granddaughter. She's mine, Irene. Not yours, not Cash's. Mine. Goodbye. Huck ends the call and feels much better for 1 second, then much, much worse. He dials Joni's mom, Julie. I hate to bother you, Huck says.
Oh, Huck, Julie says. I was just about to call you. We're frantic. We can't find Joni.
Julie is an organizer, so with a few calls, she discovers that they're all missing. Maya, Shane, Joni, Colton, and Bright Whitaker. But Julie doesn't have eyes and ears the way Huck does. He calls Rupert, tells him Maya and her little friends are at large, probably somewhere in Cruise Bay, and asks him to alert his lady friends. Meanwhile, Huck drives into town and checks first at the little beach in Chocolate Hole and then at the basketball courts across from the gas station. No Maya. As Huck is heading into the roundabout, his phone rings. It's Mick. Huck heard from Maya that Ayers and Mick got engaged, which Huck has to admit he found startling, and he wonders if Mick is calling to give him the news. Huck nearly sends the call to voicemail, but at the last second he answers.
Hey, Mick, what's up?
Hey, Huck, Mick says. Just thought you should know that Maya and her friends are hanging out on the edge of Frank Bay. I was taking a little walk, and I saw them down there. It's pretty late, so I thought...
Yes, thank you, Huck says. I'm on my way.
Huck drives to the beach bar, double parks, and strides out onto the sand. He doesn't see Maya. He heads to the left, spies a couple of kids. It's pretty far away from the beach bar. Huck wonders what Mick was doing all the way down here, and whistles. Even in the dark, he can see Maya jump to her feet. She comes running through the sand toward him.
Uh-oh, she says.
Uh-oh is right, he says. Follow me, we're going home.
Over Maya's head, Huck calls out,
Party's over, kids. I'm calling everyone's parents.
Maya sits in the truck while Huck leans against it. He really wants a cigarette right now, but he can't set that kind of poor example until every child is claimed. This gives Huck a chance to calm down and second-guess himself. Did he overreact? No. It's nearly 9 o'clock on a school night, and they were having a kumbaya sit-in on a deserted section of beach. God only knows what they were doing.
What were you doing?
Huck asks Maya once he gets behind the wheel.
Other than trying to send me to an early grave?
Talking, Maya says. And I know I was wrong, and I know I owe you an apology. I'm sorry. I also know it's not going to make any difference and that I'm grounded. But we had a crisis.
Crisis?
Colton's parents are getting a divorce, Maya says. He needed us.
Huck sighs and lets the rest of his anger go. One of the things he likes best about St. John is exactly what Maya is describing.
In times of trouble, people come together. That was true when Leanne died, and even more true when Rosie died. Why should it be any less true for Maya and Colton just because they're kids?
You should have called me, Huck says.
My phone was dead.
Not everyone's phone was dead, Huck says.
I didn't want to call, Maya says, because I thought you'd make me come home. We all made a vow we wouldn't tell our parents where we were until we knew Colton was going to be all right.
Colton is going to be just fine, Huck says.
He nearly points out that Maya just endured something far worse and she's okay. But Huck doesn't want to bring up Rosie right now, even though he misses her very, very much at this moment. Rosie would have been far more understanding than Huck about this little powwow. Rosie might have invited all the kids to pile into her car and then taken them all home herself, encouraging them to share their feelings as she drove.
He has two parents who love him.
Facts, Maya says. Unfortunately, while we were on the beach, I discovered another problem.
Oh, really?
I saw Mick, Maya says. He walked all the way down from the beach bar.
Huck nearly says, yes, he was the one who called me, but he doesn't want to reveal his sources.
And he was with Bridget. Bridget was crying hysterically. Mick had his arms around her trying to comfort her. This was before he noticed me sitting with my friends.
Yeah, Huck says.
And then they started kissing, Maya says. Her voice is flat. I'm so disgusted with him. He pulled away after a minute, but not soon enough. As soon as I get home and charge my phone, I'm calling Ayers.
For Pete's sake, Huck thinks, does the drama never end? They're adults, Nut, he says. I think maybe you should let them work it out.
He'll never tell her, Maya says. Ayers will never know if I don't say something.
Maybe that's for the best,
Huck says. He lights a cigarette and takes a long, much-needed drag.
Maybe he and Bridget needed closure.
Closure?
Maya says, and she laughs like a full-grown woman.
Spare me.
When they get back to Jacob's Ladder, Huck says,
grounded for a week. No town for 2 weeks.
Maya nods.
You lied to Cash, Huck says.
You told him I had a late charter. So then I turned around and ripped him a new one for believing you. Now your own brother can't trust you.
I'm sorry, Maya says.
Your mother hid a lot of things from me, Huck says.
He hadn't wanted to bring up Rosie, but here she is, showing up anyway.
Probably because she didn't think I could handle the truth.
Huck clears the lump in his throat.
I've learned my lesson. You promised to tell me the truth, whatever it is, and I promise to handle it. Understand?
Yes, sir, she says.
Go inside, please. There's candies on the table with extra comeback sauce. Then straight to bed.
Where are you going? Maya asks.
I have some apologizing to do myself, Huck says.
He drives to the villa, even though it's late, and Irene might be in bed. Both Jeeps are in the driveway, which Huck supposes is a good thing. He needs to apologize to Cash. He shudders when he thinks how hard he was on the poor guy. But it was Maya. When Cash has a child of his own, he'll understand. Huck trudges up the stairs and sees a light on in the kitchen. Cash is sitting at the kitchen table with his phone in front of him. Huck knocks on the sliding door and Cash jumps, then hurries to let Huck in.
Did you find her?
I did, Huck says. She's safe.
He can see the relief wash over Cash's face, and Huck feels ashamed. He's so afraid of losing Maya, even of sharing her, that he's ignoring the best part about her newfound family. There are more people who care about her.
Listen, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Cash says. I've been beating myself up since I dropped her off, wondering how I could have been so gullible.
You trusted her, Huck says. That's a good thing. I had no right to speak to you the way I did, and I hope you can forgive me.
My mom gave me your cell number, Cash says. If you ever let me hang out with Maya again, I promise I'll follow the rules and drop her only at home.
She's grounded for a week, Huck says,
but I'm sure she'll be bugging you as soon as she's a free woman.
I hope so, Cash says. He offers Huck his hand.
Thanks for coming all the way up here to apologize. That was above and beyond. But I have an early morning tomorrow.
Right, Huck says. He turns toward the door, then stops.
Is your mom still awake, do you think?
Probably, Cash says. She just headed upstairs a minute ago.
Do you want me to check?
Huck hesitates. He could just wait and talk to Irene on the boat tomorrow.
I'll get her, Cash says. I'm sure she wants to know about Maya.
Cash disappears up the stairs, and a moment later, Irene comes down. Her hair is out of its braid, wavy over her shoulders. She's wearing gym shorts and a gray Iowa Hawkeyes t-shirt. Huck feels himself trembling.
I owe you an apology, AC, he says.
Irene points at the door. Let's go outside.
This is a good sign, he thinks. He holds the door open for her, and she heads out to the railing at the edge of the deck, where they can look out over the water. The pool is gurgling to their right and glowing in ethereal blue.
Maya is okay? She asks.
She was at the beach with her friends, Huck says. I'm sorry I lost my temper.
It was understandable, Irene says. She's your girl.
That she is, Huck says. I vowed she would be my first and only priority. I can't let anything happen to her.
She's lucky to have you, Irene says. Huck throws caution to the wind and gathers Irene up in his arms. She allows this, but he can feel tension in her body.
What's wrong? He says.
The other night was magical, Irene says.
Huck loosens his hold on her, but
meeting you, becoming friends with you, has been nothing short of miraculous. That first day of fishing, it saved me.
And me, he thinks.
I love working on the boat. Not just because I like the work, but because I enjoy your company.
Did I mess things up by kissing you? He asks.
Meeting him was miraculous. He saved her. She enjoys his company. But that doesn't mean she feels romantically about him. Yes and no, Irene says. Without warning, tears pool in her eyes. When we kissed, I never thought I'd feel that way again. She sniffs. There's a way in which I've never felt that way before, ever.
That's good, right? Huck says.
It's too soon, Huck, she says. This whole situation is still so fresh. I know you don't think we need to worry about the authorities hauling us off to jail like they did the Vickerses, but I do anyway.
I'm not going to let anything happen to you, Huck says. I care for you.
Irene reaches up to touch his face. And I care for you. But I need more time. I need time. She rests her hand on the side of his neck. I want you to promise you won't give up on me.
Huck isn't sure he can speak.
He's disappointed, crushed. Can she not feel the chemistry here, the love? He's not sure how he'll be able to hold himself in check. And yet he's also relieved. Irene is nothing if not a woman of her word. She does have feelings for him. She's not ready. Is Huck going to give up on her? Hell no.
You have my word, AC, he says.
She pulls him close and rests her head on his chest for a moment. We have an early day tomorrow, she says.
You're right, he says. I should go.
It's difficult, but he releases her.
See you tomorrow, AC.
He strides across the deck without looking back, but he hopes it's like the movies, and Irene is staring after him with longing, telling herself she's made a mistake, that she is in love with Huck and should chase after him and let him know. Huck is halfway down the stairs when he sees a pair of headlights winding up the hill toward the villa. Then he sees another pair, and another, and another. Four vehicles are winding their way up Lover's Lane. Baker. On Tuesday, he calls an emergency breakfast meeting at Snooze. Once his friends are assembled and they all have coffee, he can't expect them to provide any kind of decent advice without coffee, Baker passes around his phone. On the screen is a picture of Mick on one knee, proposing to Ayers, with Cash's text, "She said yes, dude. Sorry." Debbie says, "Wow, she's hot. I know you said she was hot, but wow."
"Wow," Wendy echoes when she gets the phone. "Debbie's right."
"That's not helpful," Baker says morosely.
"Can we talk about the manipulative nature of public proposals in general?" Ellen says. "Why do people do it?"
"Insecurity," Becky says. "Fear? Or is it the opposite? Hubris?"
"I think it's romantic," Wendy says, "and fearless. Don't you think it takes courage?"
"You're off topic," Baker says. "I'm now moving myself and my 4-year-old son down to a remote Caribbean island for a woman who just agreed to marry someone else."
"This is Mick, right?" Ellen says. "The guy who cheated on her?"
"Yes."
"Ew," Debbie says. "He's not bad looking," Wendy says, "but he's not you."
"Cool dog," Becky says. "Is that Mick's dog or Ayers' dog?"
"Mick's," Baker says. "He has a cool dog, but I have a cool kid."
"There's a pizza boat in the background," Ellen says. She looks at the others. "A pizza boat. We need to plan a trip to St. John."
"We'll come visit you," Debbie says. "The villa has room, right?"
9 bedrooms, Baker says, but again, off topic. "Should I even go, or should I stay here?"
"Wearing my human resources hat, here's what I think," Becky says. "I like this move for you. It's not necessarily permanent. You go down there, you coach at the school, you get Floyd situated. He's a bright, perceptive, resilient kid, and he's a sponge. I think it'll be good for both of you to live somewhere else for a while. You're renting your house, not selling it, so you can always come back. Think of it as a sabbatical of sorts. And then, if Ayers sees the light and you two get together, you can make it more permanent." The other women nod their heads.
"What did I tell you before?"
Ellen says. "You won't hit the ball if you don't swing."
Baker appreciates his friend's advice, but there's no way he's making such a huge leap of faith without talking to Ayers. But first, Baker tries Cash. He would like some intel. Has his brother talked to Ayers about the engagement? What does he know? Cash doesn't answer his phone. Either he's very busy or he doesn't want to get involved. Baker assumes it's the latter, but why did he send the photo then? To be informative or to be a jerk? Baker tries Ayers on Tuesday evening, a full 24 hours after he received the photo. It doesn't seem quite as horrific now that some time has passed. Engagements get broken every day, right? She doesn't answer either, which could be a bad sign. She's with Mick, she's finished with Baker, she wants him to go away, in which case Baker will just stay in Houston. He doesn't leave a voicemail. No one ever listens to them. But he does shoot her a text. "Any chance I can talk to you tonight?" A little while later, there's a response.
"I'm at work. I'll call on my way home."
Baker stares at the words for a long time, trying to imagine what Ayers is thinking. Well, he'll know in a few hours. He feeds Floyd and reads him 3 stories, but Floyd is keyed up because they're supposed to leave in the morning. Floyd has already said goodbye to his friends and his teachers. He's excited to live on an island.
"Dad," he says, "islands are surrounded by water."
"That's right," Baker says.
"Grandma has a job on a boat," Floyd says, "catching fish. And Uncle Cash has a job on a boat, giving tours to people from other places."
Floyd closes his eyes.
"I want to work on a boat."
"Okay, buddy," Baker says, ruffling Floyd's hair. "We'll get you a job on a boat." Floyd's eyes fly open.
"Really?"
Baker laughs, and he thinks of what a unique and amazing experience it would be for Floyd to grow up on a Caribbean island. He'll learn to sail and navigate. He'll become familiar with the natural world. And maybe he will grow up to be a person who contributes so much to the island that it makes up for his grandfather's wrongs, whatever those turn out to be. Baker indulges in some red velvet cake ice cream, but resists the temptation of marijuana. At 9:15, his phone rings. It's Ayers.
Hey, she says.
Hey.
You heard?
I did. Cash sent me a picture of Mick slipping the ring on your finger.
Baker pauses.
I guess the breakup didn't last long.
I was taken by surprise, Ayers says.
But you said yes, right?
Baker says.
And it was still a yes once you were alone with him? I mean, I understand the manipulative nature of public proposals.
He shakes his head. He's parroting Ellen. Yes, Ayers says. It was manipulative. Good choice of words.
Ellen has never steered him wrong, he thinks. You're going to marry Mick? Even though he cheated on you? Even though you said yourself that you can't trust him?
Do you have time for a story? Ayers asks. This is something I've never told anyone. Not Mick, not Rosie, not anybody.
I have all night, Baker says.
She takes a breath. When I was Maya's age, younger even, 10 or 11, I lived in Kathmandu with my parents.
Kathmandu? Baker remembers all the photographs on Ayers' wall.
Story for another day.
In Nepal?
Yes, Ayers says. Kathmandu used to be this frenetic, dirty, dusty, poverty-stricken place where emaciated cows roamed the streets along with the cars and the motorbikes. My parents and I lived in a backpacker hostel. My mother, Sunny, tended bar at an expat pub, I can't remember the name, only that it had a snooker table. And while my mother worked, my father would try to teach me to play, but my arms were too short to hold the cue stick. Anyway, the manager of the pub was this guy named Simon, and he was the most handsome man I have ever seen in my life. And he liked my mother. Even at my tender age, I figured out that was why my father kept me in the pub playing snooker rather than exploring the city. She sighed. But my father couldn't keep me there too late, so eventually every night we'd go back to the hostel. One night, something must have happened with Simon, because my mother didn't come home. For 3 days, we didn't see her.
What did your dad do? Baker asks.
He moved us to this place called the Hotel Vajra, which looked like it was pulled out of a fairy tale. The beds had crimson silk spreads, and the doors were made of carved teak. At night, they lit pillar candles up and down the hallways, and my father and I would go to the rooftop terrace restaurant and eat lamb momos. It was a big change for me, having a hotel room to myself and eating out in a fancy restaurant, and I knew, somehow, that we were doing it only because my mother wasn't there. I think I even knew that we were doing it to get back at her. Ayers sighs. Anyway, one morning as we were headed over to Mike's, this place that served a real American breakfast, we saw my mother sitting in the front garden waiting for us. She linked her arms through ours, and we all went to Mike's and ordered big stacks of pancakes.
Did she say where she'd been?
No, Ayers says. Nothing was ever mentioned about it to me. My mother quit the job at the pub and we moved to Vietnam.
She pauses.
Now, as an adult, I can only assume my mother had a fling with Simon and my father waited it out.
Are your parents still together? Baker asks.
Yes. Ayers says. They're very happy. To my knowledge, nothing like that has ever happened again, on either side. It was like a hiccup.
A hiccup, Baker says. And that's how you see Mick's behavior with Bridget? As a hiccup?
Mick took a detour, Ayers says. But he found his way back to me. And I truly believe it was a one and done. He knows what he lost, and he won't risk it again. I've asked him for years to find a better place to live, and on our way to the boat yesterday, he drove me past this house he rented. It's gorgeous.
Where is it? Baker says. I'll buy it right out from under him.
Baker,
Ayers says. You said you have feelings for me, Baker says. You said you couldn't stop thinking about me.
That's true, Ayers says.
Even on Monday before Mick proposed, one of the mothers from Gift Hill was talking about this hot new dad, and I knew it was you, and I was jealous.
Think about that, Baker says.
I have been thinking about it, Ayers says. But Mick and I have been together a long time. He knows me. We have a life here that we built together month by month, year by year. I can't just throw that away for something new.
You can, though, Baker says, because I'm moving to St. John tomorrow, and I'm going to stay. I got a coaching job at Gift Hill. I'm going to take scuba lessons.
He doesn't know where this idea comes from. It just pops into his head, but it sounds good.
I'm going to work on getting my real estate license down there. I'm going to build a life, month by month, year by year, and I want you to be in that life. When I first saw you, I felt like I was the one who had been struck by lightning. Only instead of dying, I came to life.
Is this corny? He can't tell.
I made a decision then and there that I was going to marry you. So you can hang up with me now thinking you're going to marry Mick, but I promise you, Ayers, that I can do better than Mick. I will be true and steadfast and devoted and crazily in love with you until the day I die. I will never have any hiccups. Ever.
Ayers is quiet.
If a proposal is what you want, then you have one from me. I want to marry you as soon as I'm legally able.
You barely know me, she says, but her voice is softer. He's getting to her, maybe.
We can worry about that later.
Ayers laughs, but her laugh is cut short. Oh, hey, she says. Maya is calling in on my line, and I should take it. It's late, and she never calls me this late. She never calls me at all. She only texts.
By all means, take it, Baker says. I hope everything is okay.
Me too, Ayers says. I'll let you know. Bye. Baker stares at the blank screen of his phone. If Floyd weren't asleep, he would play the Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go at top volume. What the hell? He finds his AirPods and cranks the song up. If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. Repeat song, repeat song, repeat song. During his fourth time through, Baker is still waiting for the answer to be revealed. He sees a text from Anna. What does she want? He wonders. Louisa and I have some concerns about you uprooting Floyd, the text says. Please hold off on your move until we talk. I should have some time for a conference call next week.
Ha! Baker says to the empty living room. That's rich. That's really rich. Louisa and I have some concerns means that Louisa has concerns because Anna has said she was okay with it last week.
Baker knows the text should persuade him to stay put, but it does exactly the opposite. Louisa has concerns about Baker uprooting Floyd to take him to St. John, but Anna and Louisa uprooting Floyd to take him to Cleveland was fine. Ha! Ha! Another text comes in, and Baker assumes it's Anna burying herself even further. She doesn't even have time to talk about it until next week. But the text isn't from Anna. It's from Ayers. Maya saw Mick kissing Bridget on the beach tonight. I'm giving the ring back. Baker shuts the music off and heads upstairs to bed. He has an early flight in the morning. Rosie. January 1st, 2015. Love is messy and complicated and unfair. I see Russ when he's here, which is every few weeks for a couple of days. I'm elated for 48 hours before he arrives, and devastated for 48 hours after he leaves. Actually, the leaving part is getting worse. I see him often enough that it's getting hard to keep secret. I have to lie to Huck, say I have friends from the States in town, and would he mind watching Maya for a couple of days? Huck is always happy to do this. I think being with Maya helps get his mind off Mama. He started taking Maya out on the fishing boat. Even though she's only six, he says she's a natural, and it's important for her to get her sea legs. Huck asked the names of my friends from the States, and I said Rachel, Monica, and Phoebe. He didn't pick up on my joke. I knew he wouldn't, but he must be getting suspicious. Since when do I have friends from the States, or friends at all except for heirs? I'm sure he suspects it's a man. Russ and I can't go anywhere or do anything. He doesn't even want to risk a trip back to Miss Vi's on Hanson Bay. I visit him in room 718 at Keneal, which requires me to sneak in the back way from the parking lot. Or, if Russ has the yacht to himself, I visit him there. I show him pictures of Maya. He wants to meet her, but I'm not allowing that. Every time he leaves, I know I might never see him again. Once you prove to me you're staying here, I said, you can meet her. June 24th, 2015. Russ is leaving right before Carnival, and he says he won't be back again this summer, which means the earliest I'll see him is September, but September is hurricane season and Keneal is closed, so it'll most likely be October or possibly even November. I considered traveling to the States for the summer. Lots of people here do it. But Russ says that he has some meetings with clients in Grand Cayman and Miami, and then he and Irene are spending 2 weeks in Door County, Wisconsin. I had never heard of Door County, Wisconsin, so I looked it up on my computer, and what I found were photographs of lakes and barns and orchards and cute little towns with church steeples, ice cream parlors, and antique stores. It looks like America in the 1950s. When I asked Russ what he and Irene did there, he said they hung out on the lake, fishing, water skiing, swimming, and then in the evenings they played cards, attended fish boils, listened to the loons. He asked me how I would spend the summer, and I tried to explain about Carnival. It's a week of music, food, and dancing when nobody sleeps, and then the entire island needs a week to recover. I explained that Huck fished for blue and white marlin in the summer, which brought in a different kind of fisherman. And then in September, Maya would go back to school, and everyone would pray there were no storms. I told him 4 months was a long time to be apart. He said he knew that. Then he took me in his arms and kissed me, and said that he realized our arrangement was unfair to me, and he would understand if I wanted to find someone who could give me all the things I deserved. An engagement ring, a home, a future? I said, yes, I should find someone else. But I knew I wouldn't, because I love Russ. I didn't tell him that. I want him to say it first. He didn't say it, however. And what could I think but that he only loved Irene? I kissed him goodbye and told him to have a wonderful summer. Enjoy the fish boils in Door County, Wisconsin, and the sound of the loons. I did slip another postcard into his duffel bag, saying I would miss him. I didn't warn him about it. If Irene happened to discover it, oh well. Russ would have to explain or lie about who ML was. I'm glad I didn't allow him to meet Maya. My heart is in danger, but at least hers is safe. November 9th, 2015. Russ came back and he had good news, such good news that I'm almost afraid to believe it. His company, Ascension, was looking for investment opportunities and they partnered with a local real estate concern, he wouldn't tell me which one, to buy 140 acres in West Cinnamon, an area known as Little Cinnamon. They planned to develop the hillside, hire someone to build luxury villas. But the even better news was that the local real estate concern had built one home on spec and lost a lot of money on it, so Russ had bought the villa himself. I had questions. Why had Russ been the one to buy it and not Todd or Stephen?
They don't want a house, Russ said.
Really? I said. Then I thought, who doesn't want a house?
Really, Russ said, they have homes elsewhere. They offered it to me because they know I have interests here.
Interests? I said, you mean me?
Yes.
They know about us.
They do.
How? I said, did you tell them?
No, he said, but they're not naive, Rosie.
They weren't naive.
I'd never thought that. In fact, I'd always worried about it. This was a holdover from years earlier, the first time I laid eyes on the three of them, when it seemed like Russ was a sheep running around with a couple of wolves.
The bigger news is that we're doing more business down here, in both the USVIs and the BVIs. Maybe we could even go to the BVIs together.
You mean Yost?
Yost Van Dyke was a party island. That was true when I was growing up, but it's even more so now. Everyone loved Foxy's and the Soggy Dollar.
I mean Anegada, he said. Have you ever been?
I had been to Anegada once long ago. Before Mama met Huck, she had briefly dated a lobsterman who took us to Anegada for the day on his fishing boat.
Anegada is the most remote of the British Virgin Islands, and unlike any of the others in that it's just a spit of flat white sand. There are a few businesses, a few bars, a few homes, hundreds of flamingos, thousands of lobsters, and not much else. I hadn't been impressed with it at 13, but now, as a lover's getaway, it held enormous appeal.
When can we go? I asked.
December 18th, 2015. Russ and I celebrated Christmas and New Year's rolled into one during our 3 days on Anegada. We went over on Bluebeard on Monday, and the captain said he'd be back for us on Thursday. We stayed in a simple white clapboard cottage on the most pristine beach imaginable. I thought the sand on St. John was white, but it looks positively dingy compared to Anegada's. The cottage had a big white bed and a tiny kitchen that Russ had arranged to have stocked with provisions. Our mornings consisted of sleeping in, followed by coffee, fruit, and toast on the balcony overlooking the sea. Unlike on St. John, there were no other islands on the horizon. It was a bizarre feeling, even for me, to stare out at nothing but water. At least on St. John, I felt connected to a larger whole, seeing St. Thomas, Water Island, Little St. James, and St. Croix in the distance. Here, we might have been perched on the edge of the world. We made love, we walked on the beach, we fell asleep in the sun. In the late afternoons, our supper was delivered: lobster fritters, lobster bisque, baked, stuffed, or boiled lobster with butter. We drank champagne with our lobster, it seemed only fitting, and there were a dozen bottles of Krug in the refrigerator. I used to drink champagne with Oscar, and I had forgotten how tipsy it made me.
Now that you've bought the villa in Little Cinnamon, I said, will Irene come down?
This was my biggest fear. I could handle the idea of Irene, but I could not handle the reality of Irene coming to stay on my island.
No, he said. He went on to tell me a story about an ill-fated trip to Jamaica when the boys were young. They had wandered off, gotten lost in a shanty town near the hotel. Irene had been frantic. The trip left her scarred. She hated the Caribbean.
Besides, she's consumed with our project at home, Russ said.
He cleared his throat. He knew I disliked it when he used words like we and our to describe him and Irene. The project he was referring to is a Victorian fixer-upper that Irene had begged him to buy. She was desperate to restore it to period. I sipped my champagne and thought about Irene immersed in a home renovation project in Iowa City. How vastly different that life was from my own. I suppose that's part of the appeal for Russ, part of the point. He has a wife and a mistress. I'm not sure what else to call myself. And I suppose that we nourish different parts of him. I'm sex and lobster and champagne drinking under a blanket of stars. Irene is home and hearth, mother of the boys, keeper of the traditions that made a family. Can I lure Russ away from her? Can I make him feel his family is here? I can try. In the new year, I decided, I'm going to introduce him to Maya. February 11th. 2016. I told Maya she was going to meet a friend of mine, but that it was a secret, and she wasn't to talk about this friend to anyone, including Huck. Then I hated myself. But I can't have it both ways. I can let Maya meet Russ and make sure she keeps it quiet, or I cannot introduce them at all. Maya said she understood. She looked at me with her wise child eyes and repeated what I'd told her. Russ was a friend of mine, but I didn't want the whole island talking about it, and I didn't want Huck to know because he wouldn't like it. Why wouldn't he like it? Maya wanted to know. I could see her backing away from any situation that Huck might not approve of. Maya is devoted to Huck. He is God, Santa Claus, and Justin Bieber rolled into one. He would like it, I said. He wants me to be happy. But I'm not ready to tell Huck about it. Only you. Russ is a person for just you and me, okay? Okay, she said. We visited Russ at the villa in Little Cinnamon. When he shook Maya's hand, he slipped her a cherry lollipop, which she accepted only after I said it was okay. He asked her if she wanted to play Chutes and Ladders. She said yes, then added, "But just so you know, I always win." I won't go so far as to say it was an instant success. Maya didn't care about any old white guy except for Huck. But I will say they got along fine. Russ was charmed, maybe even smitten. And as I watched them play their game, Maya won handily, landing on only ladders, while Russ's rolls put him on only chutes. It struck me how much they looked alike, how their mannerisms were similar, their earnest, goofy enthusiasm matched. She is his daughter. No doubt about it. April 8th, 2016. Maya and I went back to the villa in Little Cinnamon last week. Russ asked Maya if there was anything he could add for her at the villa, and she said a shuffleboard court. Russ said, "I will tell the architects tomorrow to add a shuffleboard court, as long as you promise to play with me." Maya said, "I'll play with you, but just so you know, I always win." May 23rd, 2016. Love is messy and complicated and unfair. Russ's grandson, Floyd, is getting baptized in Iowa City, which is something of an issue because Baker's wife, Anna, isn't religious and has only grudgingly agreed to the ceremony.
"Anna is a doctor," Russ said, "a real smart cookie."
"Smart cookie?" I said. "Please promise me never to use that term in front of her."
"I already did," he admitted. "It didn't go over well."
I don't know anything about the baptism, except that it is happening. I imagine a church full of people with Russ and Irene sitting up front holding hands. Everyone gazes on them with admiration, not one soul guessing that Russ has a mistress and a daughter in the Caribbean. Does he think about us? I wonder. Or does he have a vault in his brain where he locks us, and all the feelings he has for us, away? May 30th, 2016. The villa needs some sprucing up, and Russ asked me to make the decorating decisions.
"I have no taste," he said. "At home, Irene handles these things."
As soon as he said this, he knew it was a mistake. The "at home" bothered me more than Irene. His home is in Iowa. This is, well, I'm not even sure what to call it. His second place, I guess. I live in second place. I told Russ I want no part of any decorating decisions. It's his villa, not mine. In truth, I don't want to pick things and then have him compare my taste to Irene's. Russ asks Paulette Vickers to handle the decorating. It's Paulette and Douglas from Welcome to Paradise Real Estate who built the villa in the first place. And just as they were about to lose it to the bank, Todd Croft and Russ swung in on a vine. Russ bought the villa and Ascension the hillside. They asked Paulette and Douglas to stay on as property managers. I know them both, but I'm not worried about Huck finding out because Paulette is a distant cousin of my father, Levi Small, and the Smalls did not speak to Mama, and they do not speak to Huck. I was concerned about what would happen once the other houses were built and sold, and suddenly we had neighbors watching my car coming and going from the best villa. When I shared this concern with Russ, he said,
"We won't have any neighbors."
"We won't?" He clammed up then, which is something he's been doing more and more frequently every time I ask him about his work.
He'd told me early on that Irene didn't have the first idea what his work entailed. She couldn't care less, he said. All she cared about was the money.
She wouldn't care if I were a paid assassin, he said.
To differentiate myself from Irene, I tried to understand what Russ did for work. He was executive vice president of customer relations for Ascension, which meant essentially that he did exactly what he'd done in college when Todd Croft was selling beer in the dorms. He lent him his trustworthy face, his cheerful good guy demeanor, and his sterling personal reputation. Ascension invested in high-risk, high-yield investment opportunities for very wealthy clients, many of them foreign. Why won't we have neighbors? I asked. We were down on the private beach. I had decided to leave Maya with Huck so we could have some alone time, sitting together on one of the brand new chaise longues that Pauline had bought. We were drinking champagne, the Krug. Russ? I was leaning back against Russ, tucked between his legs, and he murmured into my hair,
"We sold those lots to fictional entities, shell companies that we set up."
So wait, I said, is that legal?
People do it all the time down here, Russ said, to clean money, to hide money.
That wasn't my question.
Russ squeezed me tight. This is the Caribbean, Rosie, he said,
as if it weren't the only home I'd ever known. Russ is in the business of money laundering and tax evasion. I said I didn't believe him capable of it, and once I pried a little more, he admitted that he'd taken the position at Ascension thinking it was 100% above board. But once he'd figured out it wasn't, in addition to everything else it did, the company invested money for some bad people, bad both morally and politically, it was too late. He was in too deep to protest.
Then there's the fact that both Todd and Stephen know about you, he said.
Without a word, I got to my feet and bent down to kiss Russ on the cheek. Be right back, I said. I ascended the 80 steps to the villa, got in my car, and drove home. I hate that I now know Russ is cheating the system. And yet, what did I expect? He's cheating on his wife. I'm an integral part of the grand deception. I'm a lie. Maya is a lie. Mama was right, so right, to tell me to stay away from him. But had I listened? No. 3 days after she was gone, I was back in his bed. It's over, I've decided. When I kissed Maya as she lay sleeping, I thought, I am going to find a man who deserves to be your father. February 14th, 2017. The money still arrives in packages, only instead of depositing it in a bank account for Maya's college, I've started stacking it neatly in the bottom drawer of my dresser. If the money is illegal, someone will trace it to my bank account eventually. Cash is safer. Then this weekend, President's Day, a text came to my phone from a foreign number. It said,
"Please come to the villa. I want to see you. Things will change, I promise."
I blinked, read the text again, read the text a third time. Russ had never texted me before. We'd both agreed cell phones weren't safe.
"Things will change, I promise."
It wasn't a text saying he had left Irene, but I gave in anyway. I ached with missing him. March 2nd, 2017. Love is messy, complicated, and unfair. Things have not changed in any way, except that the villa is newly redone, and Maya has been allowed to decorate one of the rooms as her own. Also, I finally came clean with Huck and Ayers and told them that, yes, there was a man. I even said his name out loud once, but my relationship was nobody's business but my own. Huck and Ayers disagreed. Huck wants to meet the guy, and so does Ayers. I've put them both off, saying that when the time is right, introductions will be made. When the time is right will be when Russ leaves Irene. He says he's getting closer to making a clean break. They live separate lives. Baker and his family are happy in Houston, and Russ has just set his son Cash up in an outdoor supply business in Colorado. Once Irene finishes working on the house in Iowa City, it still isn't done. He'll move down here full-time. He doesn't talk about work, and I know enough not to ask. He spends a lot of time in the Cayman Islands as well as the BVIs, in Anegada specifically. He asked me if I wanted to go back to Anegada. It's the one place he's not afraid to be seen with me. Maybe, I said the last time he asked. I worry that he has business interests in Anegada, and I can't risk getting mixed up in them. Huck calls Russ the Invisible Man, and I don't object. That's exactly what he is. November 3rd, 2018. I haven't written in ages, and usually when I take breaks like this, it's because too much is going on for me to stop and write about it. But life has been relatively placid, if also topsy-turvy. When Russ is away, I work at LaTapa, live with Huck, hang out with Ayers, and take care of Maya, who is growing into a very cool young person. When Russ is here, I live with him. Sometimes Maya comes with me. Sometimes she decides that she would rather stay home. It's not that much fun watching you guys kiss all day, she said, even if there is shuffleboard and SpaghettiOs. We didn't tell Maya that Russ was her father. She told us. One day when it was pouring rain and there was nothing else for Maya to do, she deigned to come to the villa with me, and while she and Russ were playing Scrabble, they had graduated from Chutes and Ladders, Maya looked up and said, "You're my father, right?" Russ had searched my face in wild panic. Right, I said. How did you know? How did I know? Maya rounded the table and put her face cheek to cheek with Russ's. Come on, Mom. Really? I'm writing now not because of any great upheaval in my life, but because Ayers and Mick broke up. What happened was that Mick hired a girl named Bridget to work at Beach Bar, and something about Bridget set off warning bells with Ayers. Sure enough, a couple nights ago at 3 in the morning, Ayers drove into town and caught Mick and Bridget together. Mick was basically living at Ayers' place in Fish Bay, but Ayers threw him and his dog, Gordon, out. For the past 2 days, I've had to listen to what a disgusting liar and cheat Mick is and what an unforgivable harlot Bridget is because Bridget knew Mick was in a committed relationship and still she fooled around with him. While I do agree that Mick is weak and Bridget doesn't deserve to have another female friend as long as she lives, this situation has also led me to some painful introspection. I am Bridget. I know Russ is married, and still I am involved with him. Deeply involved. Russ showed up a few days ago. Hurricane season is now officially over, and the island is gearing up for the holidays, and I told him about Ayers breaking up with Mick because she had caught him cheating. Russ nodded distractedly. I said, "These aren't fictional characters from a book I'm reading or a show I'm watching, Russ. These are my friends. You don't know them because you can't meet anyone in my life, but they're real to me. They're important to me."
"I know, Rosie," he said. "I've been hearing about them for years. They're real to me, too."
"I want an engagement ring," I blurted out. "By the new year. Otherwise, I'm done for good. Maya just turned 12. She's a young woman, Russ. She's been very accepting of our arrangement, but someday soon, she's going to start asking the hard questions."
"I know," he said, "and believe me, I want to give you an engagement ring. Things are tough at work right now."
Tough at work, that old chestnut.
"I'm thinking about quitting," he said. "I love my income, but if I left, I'd have a shot at getting my integrity back. The things we're doing, they aren't right, Rosie."
"Don't tell me," I said. I have this notion that if I don't know any particulars, I'll be safe. I have almost $125,000 in my bottom drawer. It's a lot, but is it enough to live on for the rest of my life? I thought about Maya going to high school. I want to be able to send her to Antilles on St. Thomas, and then to college in the States. Russ must have savings, right? If not, we could sell the villa and move someplace smaller. We don't need 9 bedrooms. We never have guests. 7 of the bedrooms have never even been slept in.
Russ said,
If I quit, things will change, for the worse initially, and then for the better.
Quit, I said. November 19th, 2018. My hand is shaking as I write this. I'm thinking about calling the police, but the police here on St. John won't be able to do anything. I need to call the FBI, but if I do that, I might get Russ in trouble. I was waiting tables at La Tapa tonight when Tilda told me there was a one-top, a man, who had asked for me specifically. This was the downside of being mentioned by name so frequently on TripAdvisor. Complete strangers pretended they knew me. He's ridiculously hot, Tilda said, in a Clooney meets Satan kind of way. That description should have tipped me off, but it was a busy night, and I didn't have time to think. I approached the table and noted only that Tilda's description was accurate. The guy was attractive but scary-looking. Sharply dressed, too sharp for the Virgin Islands. Hello, I said. Welcome to La Tapa. I handed him a menu and the wine list. Can I get you started with sparkling, still, or tap water? He looked up.
Hello, Rosie, he said.
I'm sorry, I said. Do I know you? In the split second before he spoke, it clicked. Todd Croft.
Todd Croft, he said.
I wanted to scream. I did a quick survey of the restaurant. Who could help me? Skip was behind the bar. There was no way he could handle this. Ayers could, maybe, or Tilda. Or me. I could handle this. What are you doing here? I said.
How old is your daughter now? He asked. 12?
The mention of Maya made me bend down and get in his face. Get out of here, I whispered. This is my island. Mine, not yours. If your intention was to come in here and threaten me or threaten my family, I would think again. I know people. He seemed amused by that. Do you? Yes, I said. I do. I was thinking of Oscar. If I took $20,000 or $30,000 from the drawer, could I get Oscar to board Bluebeard in the middle of the night and shoot Todd Croft, or at least scare him to death? I half feared Todd would try to hire him. They were both pirates. Russ is finished with you, I said.
He's not, though, Todd said.
He pushed back from the table and stood.
That's what I came to tell you. Russ isn't finished with me. He doesn't seem to see it that way, however, so I need you to talk some sense into him.
He gave me a tight smile.
There's big money in it for you if you're persuasive.
If you want a burger, I said, in a voice loud enough to draw attention from nearby tables, you should try the tap and still across the street. Thanks for stopping in. With that, I snapped up his menu, corralled Ayers from table 11, and dragged her into the kitchen to do a shot of beer. Who was that? She asked. He was hot. I longed to tell Ayers the truth. She's my best friend, and she doesn't know the first thing about me. By choosing to be with Russ, I'm hiding from everyone else. Some creeper, I said. I sent him packing. December 31st, 2018. Russ came back the day after Christmas with a leather and black pearl choker for me. Not an engagement ring. I gave him a framed photograph of me and him in the hammock that I had taken with Maya's selfie stick. He was happy with his present. I was less happy with mine, which he could tell.
I have until the new year, January 1st, he said, right? That was the ultimatum?
I didn't like the word ultimatum or the fact that I had issued one, but I nodded. I'd told him about Todd Croft coming to La Tapa, and Russ had assured me that everything was going to be all right. He'd had a confidential talk with Stephen Johnson, Todd's partner, and he'd told Russ that he would smooth things over with Todd. There was no reason Russ couldn't make a seamless exit as long as he signed a confidentiality agreement and a non-compete. This came as a relief to me, and it made sense. Stephen was an attorney.
Let's celebrate New Year's Eve at the villa, Russ said, and then go over to Anegada on the 1st. Stephen has offered to take us by helicopter.
I've always wanted to ride in a helicopter, I admitted. Should we take Maya?
He kissed my nose. Next time, he said. This trip is just for us.
Just for us. I liked the way that sounded. He would extract himself from Ascension with the help of cool-headed, legal-minded Stephen Johnson, and we would go to Anagata to stay in the pristine white clapboard cottage, where maybe, oh please, a diamond ring would be waiting for me. When I went home to pack, I heard Maya and Joni giggling in Maya's room. I tapped on the door. They were sprawled across Maya's bed, both on their phones, which I didn't love. But what I did love was the evidence of their bath bomb business strewn about. The Epsom salts, the food coloring, the citric acid, the tropical fragrances. I chatted with the girls for a minute. They were starting to have crushes on boys. And then I gave Maya a squeeze and a kiss and wished her a happy new year. I love you, Mama, she said. I left the room, but then I peeked back in. I wanted very badly to tell Maya the truth. I was going to Anagata with Russ because he planned to propose. We were going to be a real family. But instead, I simply caught her eye and mouthed, I love you. And I closed the door. Irene watches Huck's back as he leaves. What is she doing? She's asking for more time because she's scared. She has never felt so drawn to a man in her life, and it's terrifying. She doesn't like the sensation of losing control. But what did Russ's accident teach her? What is the number one thing? She's alive. She, Irene Hagen Steele, has today and God knows how many days after. Why not spend those days falling headlong in love with Captain Sam Powers? Hey, Huck, she says. But he has disappeared down the stairs. She shakes her head. Go to bed, Irene, she thinks. You can talk to Huck in the morning. Yes, that's a smart idea. But even as she decides this, she's walking toward the villa stairs, envisioning kissing Huck through the open window of his truck. And then she sees a flash of light. Headlights, more than one pair, are coming up the hill. Huck, she calls out. The headlights get closer. And before Irene can process what's happening, four black SUVs pull into the driveway. What must be 10 people climb out of the cars and start up the steps. Irene's instinct is to back up all the way to the far railing of the deck. The first person to arrive at the top is a woman, red-haired, attractive. She flashes her badge and a piece of paper that could be a shopping list for all Irene can tell. She'd need her glasses to read it. Hello? Irene says, can I help you? I'm Agent Vasco, and as of right now, this villa, One Lover's Lane, is the property of the United States government. She looks at Irene, not unkindly. Mrs. Steele? Irene nods. Your husband, Russell Steele, bought this property, as well as the property at 30 Church Street, Iowa City, Iowa, with illegally acquired funds. We've arrested Todd Croft and charged him with 117 counts of fraud, money laundering, and tax evasion for a total of over $3.5 billion. He named your husband, Russell Steele, as a co-conspirator, and he has documentation to prove it. I'm afraid we have to seize both properties. Wait, Irene says. You're taking this house? This house, yes, Agent Vasco says. And there are federal agents at your home in Iowa City right now. But that's my home, Irene says. I invested 6 years restoring it. I live there. You may pack one suitcase of personal effects, Agent Vasco says, but I'm afraid you have to vacate the property. But my boys, Irene says, my grandson.
Irene can't think. Baker and Floyd are in Houston, but they're on their way back. Cash is asleep upstairs. I'm sorry, Agent Vasco says. I'm afraid I'll have to oversee your packing.
But I've done nothing wrong, Irene says. I met with Agent Beckett in Iowa City. I was very forthcoming. I told him everything I knew. I helped him.
I wish it were different, Agent Vasco says, but it's not. This is no longer your property, I'm afraid. For one suspended moment, Irene mentally leaves the scene. She's back on the unnamed beach, naked.